Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to the School Sucks podcast. Today, as I sit here and record this, it is April 16th. So, you know, your taxes are due. That's a thing. And also, you heard me just going on and on about how excited I was about our new spring here in New Hampshire in the last introduction. Well, guess the fuck what? I wake up this morning, pull my curtain in my bedroom, look out the window, and I find a very wintry scene. Several inches, it appears, of snow. And I thought it would be gone by now. I thought it would just burn off in the April sun, but no. It's winter here again in New Hampshire. So maybe I'll head to the slopes today instead of pulling out my rollerblades. Moving on. Today is part one in my discussion with Ben Stone. I talked in the Michael Dean intro about a sporadic, casual conversation ongoing series. And this is another show like that. Now, the title, very promising, right? I will say that it does take us a while to get into it, but we do, and we will continue this conversation. In the meantime, if you have questions or you have topics of discussion, things you would like to hear Ben and I go through together, well, there is a thread on our Facebook group, The School Sucks Project, or you can also add comments to the show page at schoolsucksproject.com. So let's get right into it. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Take care. More stuff is coming soon, and I'm serious about that. Self-esteem series will continue, if not this week, next week. I sat down yesterday with Thaddeus Russell. We discussed a little thing called slavery. So stay tuned, okay? And I hope you're enjoying your week. Here we go. I am pleased to finally welcome to the School Sucks podcast the Bad Quaker, Ben Stone. Ben, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hey, Brett. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Long overdue. I'm just now getting into your work and started listening to some of your shows and asking my audience for information, and I've really enjoyed it so far. So I'm interested in how you got started, not just with these ideas. I mean, I guess I would say first with these ideas. You weren't always a libertarian, anarchist. I'm not sure what term you prefer. But how did that begin for you?
Well, I have to give at least some credit to my parents. My mom was a very skeptical, Republican, conservative-type thinking person, and my dad described himself more as a Democrat, but he was actually very anarchist. He owned private planes and flew for years. He taught himself how to fly, and that's just that concept alone is kind of like, how do you do that? How do you teach yourself how to fly? But he did that, and he flew for years without a license. He rode his motorcycle for years without a license. Because he didn't feel like there was, he didn't feel like government had any authority to tell him what he could and couldn't do in the middle of the sky, as long as he didn't hurt anybody else. You know, how can you tell me I can't fly an airplane? It's not like, you know, with at least with a road, there's an argument that somebody had to pay for the road, so you have to pay to be on it and, you know, things like this. But in the sky, how can you make that argument? So in a sense, he was very anarchist, very libertarian in some of his thinking. So I had this as a background, and I mentioned my mom was very skeptical of things like, for instance, the official government story on how World War II went and how it started and, you know, why America was fighting. And my mom just didn't buy the standard story. And I'll even give my grandmother some odd credit, and I'm not sure I entirely agree with her, but back in 1968, 1969, when the big news of the day was the moon launches and everything, she just said, that's all fake. They're not doing that. That's entirely fake. That's just the government faking that. So I had this skepticism of government, you know, deep in my roots. By the time I was like, you know, 16 or so, 17, I was running, without getting too specific, I was running underground businesses involving illegal material in California. Okay. and being very successful about it. And part of the reason why I had such a disrespect for, you know, we'll put giant air quotes here, the law, I had an encounter with cops about that time when I was around 16 or 17. I was working in a gas station in the desert in Southern California in the heat, the summer months, and it's just miserable hot out there in the sun, pumping gas for people. And so I had worked and worked, and I had saved up enough money to buy a 6-pack of beer and the guts to go in and, you know, buy it in a store and not get carded, which was a big thing for when you're like 16, 17 years old.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And so I invited a couple friends. And so there was like, you know, a couple guys and a couple girls sitting at the park with a 6-pack of beer. Now, so you've got 3 guys and 3 girls and a 6-pack of beer. No one's getting drunk, right? And these cops show up out of nowhere. And they took our beer. And they literally took the cans and poured them on the ground as they gave us their lecture. And their lecture was, you're lucky we're such good cops. If we were bad cops, we'd be arresting you right now. And I listened to their whole argument. And, you know, their whole, it wasn't really an argument. It was just a statement of how good they were and how we ought to appreciate how they're stealing from me right now and pouring my beer on the ground. And I thought, these guys are thieves. That's all they are. I mean, it just like it dawned on me that not only were they stealing my beer, but they're uniformed in clothing that is paid for with stolen money. They're driving around in cars that are paid for with stolen money. Everything about them involves theft and intimidation. That's what they do. That's all they do.
Manipulation too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm thinking just being that age and having similar experiences and the language they would use, exactly what you're describing, like, you know what I could do to you.
Yeah.
And then they don't do it. And it's almost like, you know, if you're not paying attention or if someone's not paying attention, like apparently you were, you feel at the end of the interaction, like you want to say thank you and high five them.
Yeah.
You know, like I remember being in that mindset.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it's so odd that people don't recognize how they're being manipulated in situations like that. Mm-hmm. My reaction is not when that happened, my reaction was not a positive thing. And I hate to admit that this is how I reacted to it. Nowadays, I know better and I wouldn't do this because I do respect private property. But my response to that was, I blamed the city council. I blamed the mayor. I blamed the business people in town that, you know, that paid the taxes, that put that uniform on that guy. I blamed pretty much all old people. You know, what I saw was old people, those old people that are like 25 and 30, those old people. But I blamed all of them for tolerating such a system. And so my response was, we all piled in my car. We went down to the grocery store and I stole a bottle of Jack Daniels. I just walked in, snatched it and walked out.
Wow.
And it's like, this, you know, you want to pour my beer on the ground? Fine. This is my response. I'll go steal Jack Daniels. And I'm not saying that was right, but I'm saying that in my teenage mind, I equated the shopkeeper tolerating the police as sort of part of the problem. The tolerating these people is almost as bad as the you know, as the theft that they commit.
Mm-hmm.
So that was early thoughts back then, and I did really got into some crime and got into some pretty rough stuff. And then I met my wife, and we dated shortly, but mostly, you know, right from the beginning, we knew that we were just right for each other. And so I made an attempt to what you might call go straight, you know. I got a factory job, I got a mortgage, I did all the right stuff. We started having kids, we were, you know, making good money. We were just trying to live the normal American life. But there's always this thing eating on me, you know, that things weren't right and that that they should be right, that this is not the natural way for things to be. And this was during the 1980s. And so we ended up, we had 3 kids and I just kept working. First I worked a job in a chemical factory, and then eventually I worked my way into restaurants. I was a restaurant manager, and my wife was also a restaurant manager for a while. And then I moved into the aerospace industry, which really fit me a lot better than the other industries that I'd been in. And even there, you know, eventually, if you're in the aerospace industry, even if you're doing, like I was working on engines for, you know, private planes and big transport aircraft and things like that. So it wasn't necessarily military, but you're always doing some military work that's blended into that anytime you're in the aerospace industry. So I had found myself working on programs like the Tomahawk cruise missile and like the B-2 bomber and things that I felt, you know, I had to ignore my feelings to do the job.
Yeah.
And it was very difficult and it was very uncomfortable. And we tried our best. My wife and I tried our best to teach our kids outside of traditional, you know, government schools. We tried homeschooling. We were unschooling before the word was invented. You know, we tried to homeschool, and we were in Nevada for a while, and the hoops you had to jump through to homeschool were just ridiculous. So I said, you know what? We're just not even doing that. We're just going to not put the kids in school, and I'll teach them myself, and we're not going to use a curriculum. We're just going to do things like go places and figure out how stuff works. And it really worked great. They learned a lot during that time. There was other times when we had them in private schools. There were other times when they were stuck in public schools. But overall, I think the unschooling experience was really important for them. All three of them now are adults, and I'm very proud of them. They amaze me sometimes with the clarity of their thinking and how well they've come to understand these concepts and everything. And now I even have a grandson. My grandson is a year and 4 months old, 5 months old, a year and 5 months old. So we're really thrilled about that. So I worked in the aerospace industry for years and years and years, and you know, I was reading stuff, reading Murray Rothbard and reading Hans Hermann Hoppe and reading.
How did you find it though? That's the interesting thing to me. We're going back some time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like it was easy for me to find this stuff 7-8 years ago, but because we're talking much earlier, how did
right.
you come across it?
You know, one of them was a really weird coincidence. I was at a garage sale with my wife. This was early 80s. Mm-hmm. And I liked buying books at yard sales because you can get weird books, old college books and all kinds of weird books for, you know, like a quarter or something, 50 cents or whatever. And I found this book that appeared to be a volume of four. And it appeared to be some kind of history book, but I was unfamiliar with the author and never heard of the book or anything. And it was like a dollar or something. So I bought it. And it turns out it was For a New Liberty, Volume 4 by Murray Rothbard.
Mm-hmm.
And it blew me away. It's a history book. The four volumes are essentially everything that took place from like about the time that the first colonies came to North America up until the Revolutionary War, or up until the War of Independence. I prefer calling it the War of Independence rather than the Revolutionary War. But anyway, it chronicles in great detail that time frame, and I had just the last of the four volumes, and I was amazed by it. I had no idea Murray Rothbard was an economist. I thought he was just a historian. About that same time, I ran into Gary North's writings, which I don't necessarily recommend, but Gary North has some really good stuff. It's just that he's got some really weird stuff as well. So
yeah, I know he's done a lot of good work on college, but that's the extent of my familiarity with him.
Yeah, his theological stuff. Actually, his theological stuff is what attracted me initially,
mm-hmm.
and I read a lot of his work, and I came to the conclusion that I was rejecting pretty much everything he believed. And then I encountered his financial stuff and liked it. But so that was my earliest encounter, and that got me interested in things like the Libertarian Party in the 1980s. I'd hear Ronald Reagan on TV saying these wonderful libertarian sounding things, and they just sounded so good. It's like, yeah, government's the problem. That's it. You got it. You nailed it.
But they're easy things to say.
Yeah.
Right.
But of course, he didn't live that stuff. He was,
right.
you know, pure statist. So I bought his con for a while. And then by 1988, I had actually joined the Republican Party. I was a stand-in delegate for the convention in 88, for the Republican convention. And by 88, I had found out about Ron Paul, and I had been in conversations with libertarians in the town that we lived in California. And I had attended a few meetings, and I was starting to lean that way towards Libertarian Party, that is. And I tore up my Republican membership card, and I voted for Ron Paul in 1988. Before a lot of his supporters are even alive. And afterwards, I really got to realize how dysfunctional the Libertarian Party is and how, I hate to be rude, but how naive their way of thinking is. And I thought, you know, there has to be a refinement to this because there's so much good in libertarianism and there's so much good in the philosophy. and it's abandoned once you start trying to work in politics to accomplish these things.
Yeah,
so
sure.
I had this contradiction going on in me all through the 90s. And I would have, as my oldest daughter was growing up, I have two daughters and one son. And they're all three very unique personalities from each other. My son is very mellow, very easygoing. He's smart. He's very artistic. He's a musician. He's an artist. But he's also not one for conflict at all. My oldest daughter, on the other hand, is ripe for conflict. Let's put it that way. And my youngest daughter is fairly mellow, but she's a real deep thinker. She very rarely reveals what she's thinking. She's very much to herself. But my oldest daughter, as she was getting older and up into her teens and so forth, I would have these conversations with her where, you know, we were talking about history, we would talk about politics, we would talk about libertarianism. Mm-hmm. And she was, she and I have talked about this. She was pretty much an anarchist from birth. She never liked authority. She always would go opposite of whatever she was told, not just by me as a parent, but any authority. You know, she was in public school in, I think it was the seventh grade. It may have been sixth grade or seventh grade, somewhere in there. She was in public school, and she actually made these handouts and printed them out on our printer so that she could pass out handouts at school for anarchical principles and concepts that were on these handouts. So she and I would, once she became a teenager and I had a little bit more spare time, we would have a bonfire in the backyard, and she and I would sit out there and talk for hours. And she would challenge me, her coming from an anarchist point of view and me coming from a libertarian point of view. And she would challenge me on concepts and refine my inconsistencies that I had carried over from the Libertarian Party.
Interesting.
I became, how do I put this without going into a two-hour conversation? I've had in excess of 35 concussions. And I say that to people. And typically the response that I get is, how did you get so many concussions? And the answer is there are excess of 35 concussions. There is an excess of 35 hours of stories telling that, because each one is unique. But eventually these concussions brought about medical problems that were so severe that I had to stop working. I just couldn't go to work anymore because I was having daily headaches, and I was having crippling pain and so forth. So I had to retire. I was forced to retire, and that was not at all by my choice, by the way. But that was, I believe, in 2002, if I recall. And that gave me more time to read. At that time, I had almost lost the ability for reading and comprehension. I could read. I knew the words that I was looking at and so forth, but I had a real hard time, you know, following a whole paragraph. And writing was out of the question. I could make any letter with my hands, like any, you know, kindergartner or first grader could. But I had a real hard time. I was having trouble in my mind telling my mind, or my mind telling my hand, how to function to actually write out stuff. It would be so stressful that my hand and my arm would start to cramp up and I would start going into a headache.
Yeah.
So I knew I needed to exercise my mind. So I started reading the driest things that I could get my hands on. I liked Tolkien and I liked the Tolkien stories and so forth. So the natural thing is to read the Silmarillion, which is about the driest Tolkien thing that you can possibly read. Started reading that over and over and over and retaught myself reading comprehension. And then I needed more, and I had forgotten about Murray Rothbard and Gary North and that stuff. I hadn't completely forgotten about it, but it was off the table. I wasn't thinking of it at the time. And then I, on the internet, about 2002 or so, I bumped into the Mises website, and I found Gary North again, and I found Murray Rothbard, and I found Walter Block and all these guys. And so I just started consuming in mass quantity as much Murray Rothbard as I could read. I got a hold of, pretty much all that stuff that I could get from the Mises Institute, as many of the audiobooks as possible, as many lectures as possible. And I just consumed it as much as I could. And that, along with the debates with my daughter, refined my thinking. And I should throw one other thing in there. Right around the same time frame, I was playing an online, a massive online game, where the owners of the game, there was an economy within the game, and the owners of the game, in my opinion, destroying the economy inside the game because they kept adding money into it because they had more and more new players constantly coming in.
And you said they were destroying, you cut for a second, you said they were destroying the economy?
Yeah, they were destroying the economy of the game. They were trying to help,
yeah.
But every time they pumped more money into the game, they would harm the real producers in the game, which I was, you know, a real high-level player, and there were several other of us that were very high-level players. And every time they would drop money into the game, they would just wipe out the economy. And again, this is like, you know, 2001, 2002 when I was playing that. And so without realizing it, I taught myself, this is actually before I even found the Mises Institute, I taught myself Austrian economics through observation of this online game and seeing how what they were doing when they pumped money into it. And so I became an Austrian economist even before I knew that there was such a thing as an Austrian economist.
Mm-hmm.
And I got into a very personal conflict because as a high-level player in the game, I knew the programmers and I knew the owners of the game and so forth. And so I got into a conflict with them over this, trying to explain economics to them from an aircraft engineering point of view, which, you know, leads no legitimacy to my argument.
Mm.
And so I got sick of it and quit the game. And then at the same time, trying to learn about economics, I found the Mises Institute and started consuming all this stuff, like I was saying.
Sure.
So technically, I had to relearn all this stuff in 2002, 2003, 2004, in that time frame. And at the time, I was on the internet in probably a dozen different pseudonames and different fake names in different locations and different posting boards and different forums. And I was, you know, pushing these ideas of liberty and sound economics and so forth as much as I could with these different names and different personalities, and including YouTube and anyway. Mm-hmm. And at some point, there was a person who was very close to me and that I was working with in a survival type forum that said, you know, Ben, you have a really good product here, but there's one thing that you lack. And that is everywhere where you post this stuff, you're doing it anonymously or you're doing it hidden behind a fake name. And if you want people to take you seriously, let them know who you are. You have a certain amount of legitimacy in people just knowing who you are, that you're not hiding behind some fake name. You're not some 12-year-old in their mom's basement that's making this stuff up, that you actually have experience in life that you can share with people.
Right.
So I took that as very serious advice, and I thought about it, and I talked to my wife, and I talked to my daughter, and a few other people that were very close with me, and I had this circle of people that encouraged me that said, you know, why don't you, at the same time, I should throw this in, at the same time, I was considering things religiously because I had pretty much abandoned everything that I had been taught religiously, and I had come to the conclusion that I was a Quaker in my beliefs, in my religious beliefs, except mm-hmm. I'm not a pacifist, and pacifism is sort of a trademark of Quakers.
Sure.
So I thought, well, I'm not a, and I said this as a joke on several occasions. I said, well, I'm a Quaker, but I'm not a very good Quaker. Or I would say, right. Well, I'm a Quaker, but I never said I was a good Quaker. I'm, you know, and so it kind of became a thing I can look kind of scary sometimes, let's put it that way. So, and that's not my fault. I mean, you know, I didn't decide to have hair on my face or that. You know, I've tried to cut it off several times. And it comes right back. So, you know, it's not like.
Sure.
So it fell into using this this name Bad Quaker. And we thought, well, that is something that can stick in a person's mind. It's Google friendly, and I think I can do this. So I started consolidating all of my writing and only doing it at badquaker.com and only publishing it there and publishing under my real name with my face and saying, this is who I am, and you can believe it or not believe it, but at least you can't say I'm a personality to do this. Yeah. At or around that time, you know, writing was still really difficult for me. It would take to put out, let's say I put out a 1,500 word article, that would maybe take me 30 hours of work to do that. I would struggle with it that much. And so my daughter, Kai, and my wife also encouraged me, why don't you just record the thing instead of going to all that trouble to write it all out? And as it turns out, I've got a fairly decent voice. Again, it's no more my fault than my beard is my fault. It's just, you know, we get the cards that we're dealt, and we have to play with them.
Right.
So I started recording with Kai at first, with my daughter, and we would work off of each other. And then I would sometimes just record reading my articles that I had read or that I'd written, and that was going along pretty good. And then we'll bring Michael Dean into the story. Michael Dean found me and got a hold of me and said, you know, you have the potential of sounding really good, but you don't sound really good. You sound horrible. I can fix that for you. And Michael took his magical talents and showed me how to make good sound come across the internet. And that's where we got to where we are.
All right. So we covered over 30 years. Right there. And you might be, I would have to check my archives to confirm this, you might be the person who has understood these ideas longer than anyone else I've ever interviewed. Because we're going back to the early to mid 80s. So I've recently been consuming a series that you did called Beyond Civil Disobedience. And I was really engaged and I was really enjoying it. And you were fleshing out a lot of thoughts that I had, especially since moving here to Keene, New Hampshire, which is certainly the civil disobedience capital of the Free State Project, or it has been in the past.
Right.
I started to think, while you were going through your story, considering how long you've been involved or even just observing the spread of libertarian or anarchist ideas, how would you assess that over the last 30 years? Do you think it's been a positive trend? Because obviously we could say, yes, technology has changed everything and made things so much easier, but there's also the state to consider and people's embrace of it. So if you were to look over the course of the last 30 years, how would you assess the spread of these ideas or the embrace of these ideas?
Well, first off, you know, we've moved ahead so well, and it's just amazing to go from where we were as a movement in 1977, 78 to where we are today. The work that's been done in Keene is just amazing. And watching some of the stuff that's gone on there, I talk quite a bit about the Robin Hood of Keene movement and what a great thing that is and how important it is. But not only that, a lot of the other stuff that was done there in Keene, the 420 stuff that's gone on, and, you know, when Derek Jay was there filming the movie that he later put out, in that really good movie, which name evades me at the moment.
Victimless Crime Spree. Yeah.
Derek Jay's Victimless Crime Spree. And that is really a good movie. And if you haven't seen it, folks, you really need to take a look at that. But all the work that is done there is just really amazing. When I started this out in the late 70s, for me, my level of activism was what I now look back on and kind of shake my head and say, man, what an idiot. But I was doing direct attacking my enemy. So I would go in the middle of the night with a pair of linemen's wire cutters and cut all the antennas off of police cars. Or just walk up and pop the window of a police car with a pair of pliers, or urinating on the seat, on the front seat of a police car, or just pretty much anything like that I could do to fight who I considered my enemy and not get caught. One thing in Southern California in the desert, there's an interesting thing. You have, you know, probably 10 or 11 months a year where you don't get one drop of rain. And then all the mm-hmm. rain for the year will come in a matter of a few weeks. I realize we're in a polite audience here, but if you urinate on pavement in Southern California at the right time of the year, it will stay there. The scars of that urination will stay there for a year. So I would go in front of the police station in the middle of the night and write in urine phrases. It was which you could write it fairly large because you can add to it each night.
Sure. Yeah.
And so I would write down the street in front of the police station phrases showing my feelings towards the members of law enforcement. And there's nothing they could do about it. It's there tattooed on the street for a year, you know. So I would do things like that, which now I look back on and think, what good did that do? Did that convince some old lady not to pay her taxes? Or did that convince, you know, it certainly didn't convince the cops of anything. It just made them more angry and hate me more.
Yeah.
So really, what was I doing that was of any value? And over the years, as I've watched these things and I've looked at different ways to protest and different ways to express your, you know, the frustration that we have with government and so forth. And I've changed my conclusions a lot, including just in the last couple of years. You know, I say in that series, well, when I did that series, I kind of got I stepped on some people's toes, because a lot of people have invested a lot of themselves in civil disobedience. And I'm not necessarily opposed to civil disobedience, but civil disobedience in its purest form is for the purpose of changing the existing government or getting the existing government to change particular policies. It's not for the purpose of getting rid of the government entirely.
Sure. You talked about it being in the same category as voting, essentially.
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking as I was listening to that, you said that the primary responsibility of people who are trying to forward these ideas is first, and you can correct me on my language, I'm paraphrasing from memory, to insulate themselves and their families from the predations of government, but also to expose the religion of the state. And I certainly see how civil disobedience can do the second part, but it has kind of a, in many cases anyway, I don't want to paint with, you know, a totally broad brush here, but in many cases it has kind of a self-destructive aspect to it as far as the insulation from the predation of the government.
Yeah, it really does. You take some famous cases of, you know, within our movement, you take some famous cases where individuals did things for the purpose of civil disobedience. A very famous one last year was...
Kokesh?
Yeah, thank you.
Yep.
Adam Kokesh made this tremendous sacrifice, put himself at great, you know, at the risk of great harm, and film this video of him expressing his frustration with the government by carrying a shotgun to a place where the government doesn't allow anything like that. Filmed it, put it out there, and then his house got raided, his life got turned upside down, his family was out a bunch of money. I mean, people were put at risk over it. Ended up being in jail for an extended period of time over that, and then having to stand in front of a judge and apologize and all that. And I'm not putting him down for that. I'm using that as an example.
Mm-hmm.
To weigh in a balance and say, what did this accomplish? Did it drive us, you know, and maybe it did. Maybe there are people who saw that and that was the final straw it took for them to abandon the state and say, yeah, this thing is goofy. Why do we need the government at all? But think of the amount of harm it did to Adam's life, to the people around him, to his own personal wealth, to the, you know, the how much it cost his family, how much it cost his friends, all the people that had to donate to try to, you know, to get him help and to get him a lawyer and get him out of there. And how do we weigh something like that and say, you know, is it worth that kind of investment?
Yeah.
Could we use that wealth and that time and that effort and that talent? Could we have used it in some other way to accomplish a better result?
Yeah, I've tried to really understand, too, just differing hierarchies of values that people might have. You know, I've had the same conversation with Derek. I've had the same conversation with Ian Freeman. You know, the equation is for me, like, how much more useful are you on the keyhole side of a jail cell, you know, where you can have access to a studio and microphones and be producing things that can reach thousands of hearts and minds? Because unfortunately, you know, the world in which we live today, it's just like most people, you know, even dedicated pursuers of liberty, once you're in jail for 3, 4, 5 weeks, most of those people, a significant majority of those people, are not thinking about you while you sit in a jail cell on a daily basis anymore.
Right.
I was horrified when I heard what happened to Adam. That's very scary. I only know Adam as an acquaintance. I like Adam, but I wasn't thinking about him 3 or 4 weeks later. I was back to my own life and my own pursuits. So yeah, it's a tremendous cost, and I'm still trying to really understand the benefit of it.
Yeah, and if you think of really famous cases of civil disobedience, you think of Nelson Mandela, you know, getting thrown in jail for years and years and years, suffering the way he suffered. You think of somebody like Gandhi, the way that he suffered, and you know, you could name half a dozen other really famous people like that, Martin Luther King. But then step back and look at the results. What is the results with Nelson Mandela? Well, he became the government. He became the state. He became the enemy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you think of Gandhi. Gandhi had all these great ideas. He said all these wonderful things. He suffered for what he believed in. And in the end, all the people of India did was exchange their English masters for Indian masters. And now they have an oppressive government where you can be dragged out of your house for some weird reason and set on fire as a punishment or some sure. goofy thing like that. So what did he really accomplish? You know, what was the other one I meant? Oh, Martin Luther King. Wow, that didn't work out very good for him at all, you know?
It didn't work out for him. It didn't really work out even on a larger scale. It became a movement about assimilation. It's the same thing, I think, with gay rights today. It's not like acknowledge the existence of, as much as it can exist, and I know there'd be a lot of debate about this, but a unique cultural identity for a certain group of people. It's more like, let us have the privilege of assimilating into your intolerant and somewhat oppressive system.
Right.
Because that's a victory for us to be welcome, to have the privilege to join it.
Yeah. So I had in that series, Beyond Civil Disobedience, and I might say I've got the notes. Someday I have to grow the spine strong enough to finish that series and say the final things that have to be said. Mm. But we have played nice. We have done things according to the rules. We have gone. And, you know, there's this other side, too. I should mention this. There's a lot of people that tend to think towards the right wing type thinking.
Sure.
And they think that the answer is in loading up their guns and, you know, and starting a next revolution or a new revolution or, you know, furthering the revolution or whatever. But that's not the answer either, because if you're going to take guns and go after a government, you're playing their game according to their rules. You're going exactly the way they want you to go. Mm. And every time there's been a revolution, it's always done the same way. The people think that the government is the problem, so what we need to do is get those guys out of there, and we can't do it under other means, so we're going to have to use violence. And so then they use violence, and they kick out the government. But what do you know? A new government comes in, and it's worse than the old. And that happens 100% of the time.
Yeah.
So we have to learn these lessons, and we can't just keep repeating the same mistakes and putting it off for future generations. At some point, we have to understand what the answer is. And I believe that the answer is in the market. I believe we have to, you know, I've said this before, I've used this example a lot of times. If you had a time machine and you could jump backwards in time to say 1500 or 1600, and you could take with you a bucket of iPhones and the technology to build a cell tower and a generator, and you could just appear in the year 1700 in downtown Paris with a bucket of iPhones and the technology to build a cell tower, mm-hmm. you would never be able to sell any of those iPhones, and they'd never let you build a tower. There's no way, because they wouldn't have the vision to understand what you were selling.
Right.
So there was no market for it, but there's a market for it today. And the reason there's a market for it today is because bit by bit, people began to understand the importance of communication, and they understand these mechanisms, and they understand how these things work, and now they want it, and they'll pay lots of money to have these communication devices. Well, it's the same way with the product that we're offering. We have to create a market for it. We can't just run in, stick a gun to people's head and say, now you're going to be free or I'm going to shoot you. That's not going to work. And we can't go in and take over a government and then micromanage how freedom is going to be or what liberty looks like. We have to bring this stuff onto the market and let there be a market desire for it. When there's a market desire for something, nothing can stop it.
Right.
And that's what we have to create. We have to create a market desire. Now, one of the ways that we can do that, going beyond civil disobedience, is to help the government in its incompetency. one of the metaphors that I used in that series was to don't confront the government nose to nose. Instead, spread Legos all over the carpet in the middle of the night, so when it gets up to go to the bathroom, it steps on those Legos and falls down the stairs. We want the government to kill itself. We don't want to be the ones, you know, actually shooting it. We want people to see what the government is in its truest form. And that is violence. That is hate. That is, you know, theft, aggression, intimidation. That's what the government really is. And so if we can show that, show the incompetency of the government, that it can't even do the things that it claims that it's the only one that can do it. You know, the roads argument. Well, who would build the roads? Well, the government's not doing a very good job right now. These roads stink. You know, people die constantly because of the highways. So we can help those things along. We can do things to enhance the incompetency of government. And some of that stuff can be done within the government, getting paid by the government to do those things.
Sure. So it sounds like we're really on the same page here, because obviously with the show that I do, and when I talk to ordinary folks, you know, people who don't understand or embrace these ideas about the School Sucks Project, their first question is usually very predictable. Well, what would you do? What kind of system do you want to build? Are you saying you want to get rid of public schooling, you know, those kinds of things? And, you know, I believe that the government will take care of itself and the school system will go down with it. And it's my job, using my experience and my expertise, to talk about the good ideas that should go in its place. I don't see myself as fighting the public education system. I'm not fighting Common Core. I'm not fighting the Department of Education. I'm thinking that those things are underneath a crumbling structure, and sooner or later, they'll probably be gone. And in the meantime, I want to pull out any individuals who are willing from being in the shadow of that collapse. But whether we're talking about educational freedom or the larger picture of political liberty, you have to make people want what you have. You have to make this look appealing. And that, I think, helps create that market demand for this. Right?
Yeah, you're exactly right. That is exactly it. And once there is a demand for something, and it doesn't matter what it is, if it's iPhones or education or freedom or pickles, you know, it doesn't matter what the item is. When there's a demand for it, the market will supply it. Anything there's a demand for, the market will supply it. And any attempts to stop that process will be futile on the part of government.
Right.
And there's a tremendous desire for real education right now. And I think that's one of the main things that drives the internet, is the possibility that you can, you know, if you can word a search phrase correctly, you can find out almost anything. That's amazing. What a time to live.
Yeah. It's been a big part of the School Sucks Project is obviously helping people embrace that. And I felt like, you know, in the beginning, there was a tremendous, like, starting from scratch. Like, what do most people know? What do most people think? That's where the show began. And we spent a good 100 episodes, you know, digging ourselves out of the hole that government school throws a lot of people into. And I get sucked back into all that negativity now and then, if I'm not careful, for sure. But, you know, after doing it for a couple of years, I said, well, this better become productive here sooner or later, because how long will people just listen to horror stories and sob stories? And so that's what I've really tried to make the focus of the show. And everything that is useful to me today, and I say this on the show all the time, I learned pretty much for free online by myself.
Right.
Now, there's certainly other voices involved, right? But I took the initiative, I took the notes, I integrated, and I made it useful in my life. And that's a big part of our message with my show.
I think it's really important, you know, in dealing with raising kids and so forth. What I experienced myself as a kid in school, and then what I've observed with my own children, raising them and watching them become adults and everything, a person can be forced to memorize things, or a person can choose to learn something. And choosing to learn something out of your own curiosity and your own desire to know how things work, or know, you know, that is far more powerful than any system that's going to force a kid under regiment conditions to try to, you know, memorize things and score on points on a test, or, you know, any of those things that seem so unnatural to human activity.
Yeah, I was thinking about my experience working in various school environments and being in graduate school and listening to the frustrations of a lot of active teachers who had gone back to get their master's degrees in states like, well, primarily Massachusetts and New York. And it dawned on me, I was reading, we were actually doing a series on a book by Nathaniel Brandon called The Six Pillars of Self-Esteem. And, you know, he does this chapter where he's talking about self-esteem in schools. And it really, I mean, even though it's something that I've known since probably pretty early in my career, just how unnatural the school environment is. Great teachers and great parents or other mentor figures, they share, you know, not just a belief in the potential of the people that they're trying to affect, but also a concern, a genuine concern for them and the ability to share that concern. And I just remember being a teacher and listening to teachers and thinking about all of the bureaucracy and all of the other things that were being put in my head about what school needed to be and what it needed to provide and checklists and lesson plans and state standards numbers. And the kids became an inconvenience in the whole bureaucratic process, which as far as like what it real natural learning is, it was pretty much the opposite, because we were supposed to be the facilitators. The kids had been taught that they were dependent on us for their education, but they were just, you know, part of the problem. Another thing, after all the paperwork was done, that we had to worry about. So we had nothing left for them. And it was not nurturing. It was not constructive. And at the same time, they were never given the message that you just spoke of, that, hey, this is kind of up to you. And when you make it up to you, it makes a huge difference in not just the process, but also the finished product as far as what you get out of the educational experience.
Yeah. I saw that to a certain extent. I was talking about that game that I played online. And I saw that to a certain extent in that game, because there was a wide variety of people of different ages playing the online game. But as you can imagine, it was more attractive to, say, teenage male, you know, teenage boys. The online, you know, swords and that kind of thing, a lot more than most other parts of society.
Sure.
So I had an active, like I said, I was a high level player because I've been playing it literally since the game began, since the programmers released it on the internet. And so I was a high level player, and I had I was a very wealthy player and things like this. And I would have quite literally hundreds of people as an audience, you know, on the game, talking to them and explaining economic theory to them and, you know, talking about sound money and talking about what, how much harm it does to have a fiat currency where some arbitrary, you know, wise man somewhere decides the economy needs to be pumped again. And I had people seeking me to find these things out, even though I was not an economist and barely had a grasp on them myself. But there's this desire to learn. And what is it they're learning? Boring economics. Why would a 13-year-old kid be interested in economics? Well, because it's become fascinating. He saw firsthand how it works in an economy in the game. And here's a guy that's explaining to him what's happening, how it's happening, why it's happening. And he takes an interest in it. Now, what a bizarre thing to have 200 15-year-old boys interested in economics. But that's what we see happening all around us.
There's a great appeal, and I learned this from teaching as well, in economics, it just relates to this so well, because there's that moment, right? And for me, it was in the same book that you mentioned, and I just want to reiterate that for audience members who haven't read For a New Liberty. It was probably the most transformative book I ever read, and I listened to the audiobook, but there's a chapter in that book that's the business cycle, right?
Right.
And I had to listen to it. I mean, it was just pretty abstruse, and I had to listen to it over and over and over again to really, really grasp it, because my knowledge of economics was so minimal. But that experience of you've been lied to your whole life, you know, that experience is really jarring. And, you know, I had it in college with like a very liberal democratic socialist history professor who introduced you know, the revisionism to us. That woke me up. That got me excited. Wait a minute. People haven't been telling me the truth. And I think economics is a great way to do that with people, because what they've been told, which if just, you know, a cursory examination, it sounds like it makes sense. Yeah, we create jobs by pumping money here and pumping money there, and this helps the economy. Oh, sure. Yeah, that sounds like it makes sense. You know, until you think about it, until you learn a little bit. And I'm actually surprised how many people are attracted to liberty through economics.
Yeah. You know, I misquoted there, too. The very first Rothbard book I got was Volume 4 of Conceived in Liberty, which is very history-based. It wasn't until after that. That introduced me to Murray Rothbard's work. And then I found For a New Liberty. But absolutely, For a New Liberty, man, I couldn't think of a better book to suggest to a person to read if they're unfamiliar with Rothbard's work.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to be respectful of your time. If you are out of it, we could do a whole part two. I have so many more things we could talk about. Would you be up for that?
Sure. I'm kind of busy for the next couple of days, but absolutely, we could do that.
Yeah, I just put out a thread on our Facebook group and asked people for some things that I could look into or ask you about. We covered a lot of it, but I would actually like to explore the Civil Disobedience, Beyond Civil Disobedience series in a little more detail. So why don't we just reconvene? I'll make this available to my audience, and you know, they can provide their feedback, and we can go from there. But I really enjoyed the conversation, Ben. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Brett.
My pleasure.